Hello and welcome back to Off the Hour Friday. I'm your host, Carla. And to start off, I'm going to play you Edwin Rafael, Hate It When You See Me Like This. This is CKUT 90.3, and this is Friday Off the Hour.
Dancing, different high matter. Cold as your night, don't mind me, as lovely as you are. Move like you're stealing clues, something so synchronized. Feelings don't matter to you.
That was Edwin Rafael, Hate Me When You See Me Like This. This is CKUT 90.3, and this is Off the Hour Friday. I'm your host, Carla Desir, and I'm joined by a very special guest, my friend Samya, making her radio debut.
I got demoted to friend and not best friend, but hi guys.
Sorry, my best friend Samya, who's here to host with me the Friday show. We're going to talk about some news stories. We're both poli-sci majors, so we like talking about the news. And yeah. Anything else you want to add?
Nope. Let's get started.
So, first off, this is from CBC. Black man handcuffed while getting into his own car, suing Montreal police for $125,000. For context, a Montreal man, Bryce Dosa, is suing the city's police force and two of its officers for $125,000 after he was wrongfully arrested and handcuffed last November while getting into his own car by two undercover police officers who did not identify themselves, and he couldn't find the keys to handcuff Dosa after they realized their mistake. The video went viral on social media, and rightfully so, because it is absolutely abhorrent. After the incidents, Bryce Dosa was diagnosed with PTSD. He received no apologies from the SPVM or from the city, and he is now seeking $20,000 in damages for lost income and travel costs, $30,000 for stress and inconvenience, $15,000 for pain and suffering, and $30,000 from each of the officers in punitive damages. I don't know about you. I feel like $125,000 is kind of lowballing it. I feel like you could definitely get more because that video was absolutely horrific.
No, but like if I was in his place, I honestly don't know how I would react. It's disgusting. I don't know what they were thinking. How would you know that a police officer is undercover. I think that's just ridiculous. And at this point, that's just blatant racism from the SPVM.
Yeah, and I'm not shocked coming from the SPVM because it's an institution that is just, like, really refused to reform its practices in any way. Mm-hmm. But also, the fact that he received no apology, I think that's what, like, bugs me the most, because I feel like that's the least you could do, especially after the police officers realized that what they did was wrong and that, you know, maybe they should have. I mean, here's the thing. They assumed that he was stealing his car, first of all, which I think I see that as a microaggression of, like, you know, seeing a man trying to get in his car and you just assume that he stole it because it's a nice car.
No, it's not microaggression at this point. I believe it's just racism.
Yeah.
Because it's a black man getting into a nice vehicle, you assume he's stealing the car. That's straight up racism.
Yeah.
But as you said, I feel like they should have definitely apologized as soon as they realized what they have done was a mistake. I feel like if it were to be any other race, I feel like the situation would be handled differently. And also, apologizing to the man is the most humane thing they can do.
Yeah, but I feel like at the same time they don't want to apologize because that would be a recognition of guilt, and I feel like then you realize that they can get sued for a lot more money. And I would also like to add to the story, I don't know, I feel like the undercover cops are so tricky. Mm-hmm. Because, like, you don't know. Like, maybe someone is telling you that they're an undercover cop, but until you see the badge, you have no idea of, like, making sure. Because there are people who do, like, citizens arrest, and, you know, those are valid. I mean, I don't know in Canada if they're valid, but I know that they're a thing in the U.S. You could do a citizens arrest, and a lot of people power trip with that. So, like, I understand why you see two plainclothes officers coming up to you and being like, you stole your car. You're not going to respect them because it's like, who are you? Like, you're...
No, and first of all, like, fraud is prevalent, especially in our society, in our time, and there's so many different ways, and people could be pretending to be an undercover cop and just trying to steal your car.
Yeah,
like, you have no, like, at that situation, I if I was in that man's position, I don't know how I'd react. I think, would you even believe that's an undercover cop? How many stories have you heard with undercover cops in Montreal?
I mean, not that much.
Not that much. I didn't even know they existed.
I mean, they exist, but, like, usually I feel like undercover cops are used for, like, you know, sting operations, not,
yeah, like,
you know,
bigger operation, bigger scale, like, where, catching a criminal.
Yeah, where it makes sense to be undercover because you don't want them to, you know, change their pattern of behavior. But if it's just a man trying to get into his car,
or someone else's car, I don't think an undercover cop is necessary.
Yeah, and is it worth it blowing your cover as an undercover cop because someone
was breaking into a nice car,
yeah,
quote unquote.
Yeah. There's going to be developments in this. Honestly, I hope he wins because, honestly, the police is in big need of reform, especially the SPVM.
I think it's, like, a big wake-up call for them.
I hope it's a big wake-up call. And honestly, I feel like he should be awarded more.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, our news story number two. Guy Lafleur, c'est un héros, un géant qui fait rayonner Turceau. Those were the words pronounced by Premier François Legault, and I can see your face. Yeah, so Highway 50, which is the east-west route spanning from Gatineau, Quebec to Mirabel, Quebec in north of Montreal, will now be known as Autoroute Guy Lafleur. Mm-hmm. The highway passes through the hockey great hometown of Turceau in western Quebec, and François Legault had a press conference there to announce that they were renaming the highway after him. Legault praised Lafleur's poise and character and pointed to his affinity for his hometown, saying he wasn't just good on ice, he was an exceptional human being too, an accessible man, a generous man, a humble man, close to the world, direct, sometimes too much. And close to his root, he was proud to say he was from Turceau. Just to give a little bit of context to Guy Lafleur, because, Samia, I know you're not a big hockey fan.
No, I totally know who he is.
You do know who he is because I took you to the memorial with me.
Yes, and we never got interviewed.
We never got interviewed, but we did run into a Habs player.
Yes, we did.
We did. So, Guy Lafleur, nicknamed The Flower and Le Démon Blanc, Lafleur won 5 Stanley Cups in his Hall of Fame career. Drafted first overall by the Montreal Canadiens in 1971, he scored 560 goals and 793 assists for 1,343 career points in the regular season over 17 years with Montreal, the New York Rangers, and the Quebec Nordiques. He still holds a number of Canadian franchise offensive records and has entered the Hockey Hall of Fame in 1998. As you all know, last year he passed away after a battle with cancer.
I think personally that that's a beautiful way to commemorate his memories.
Yeah.
It's, I think, you know, many people, like, he touched many people's lives. Many people are inspired by him. Many hockey players follow in his footsteps. I think that's honestly, like, one of the good things Legault has done. I'm proud of you. I think that's a beautiful way to commemorate his memories.
Yeah. I saw a lot of people complain online of, like, oh, they should have done it sooner. Mm. Which I don't know what the ethics are about naming a highway after a living person. I feel like that's a bit weird.
I think, like, especially, like, at that scale, I think paperwork, legislative work is just, it takes time.
Yeah.
It's not, like, as easy as we may all think it to be. But I think out of all the ways we can commemorate his memories, I think this one was very thoughtful and very nice.
Yeah, I know they did name, they renamed Anse-Cartierville, like the electoral writing, they renamed it Maurice Richard. So, and like Maurice Richard's been dead for like, you know, over 20 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I don't really understand people who are like, oh, this should have come sooner. Because, I mean, I understand, like, first off, he was celebrated during his life, not just like after he died. Like, he was celebrated well before that. Mm-hmm. Because everyone knows who Guy Lafleur is.
Like, even me, I'm not a hockey fan, and I knew who he was.
Yeah, you knew who he was. Yeah, he's like this, like, he's like a big, like, sports figure.
And he's a big person for, like, the city of Montreal, I would say.
Yeah, for the city of Montreal, for his hometown of Terso. I'm sure that they're, like, really proud of him. Mm-hmm. And they have been for decades. But yeah, like, I don't know, like, you can't really, like, name something as big as a highway after a living person. I think that's, like, the... I know, I feel like there's something weird about the fact that, like, I don't know, Guy Lafleur driving on Guy Lafleur, like, Memorial Highway, like, it feels weird.
No, but since he, you know.
Yeah, he passed away, which, passed like, away. From what I understand, that's the protocol. You have to, like, wait a year after the person's died to name something in their honor. Mm-hmm. And honestly, of, like, all the names, all the things that are named after people in the city, I feel like it's the most appropriate.
It's very fitting.
It's very fitting. It's not, like... You know, the airport, that's a lot of controversy. The fact that it's called, like, Pierre-Elliott Trudeau, like, it's kind of a slap in the face of every Quebecer because, like, he was not the most well-liked in Quebec. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a good thing. And also, like, François Legault is, like, a mega hockey fan.
Yes, he is.
And he's a major Habs fan. The number of times I have been on Twitter and I've seen him, like, tweeting after a game being like, man, this team sucks. And I'm like, wow. I can relate.
Very passionate.
Very passionate. But, you know, hockey here is, you know, a big factor of life. It's a big part of our...
I mean, I feel like even if you're not so into hockey, even me, like, I don't know how... I met a hockey player. No clue he was a hockey player.
Yeah.
But I feel like hockey is so ingrained in our... Wherever we are. Like, in Montreal, like, hockey is so ingrained. It's like... It's in our nature. It's everywhere.
Even if you don't watch hockey, you know about Carey Price, you know about Brandon Gallagher.
You know about the ads on TikTok with Nick Suzuki and
Cole Caulfield trying to teach you the basic rules of hockey in a very monotone tone. Yeah, that is an ad campaign that the NHL has recently launched where they get Nick Suzuki and Cole Caulfield of the Montreal Canadiens to explain to you rules.
I think Cole Caulfield is absolutely adorable because he looked visibly stressed.
They're very camera shy. I feel like that's what I noticed of It's very cute. It's very adorable. I think it's a great gesture. Honestly, I feel like we should rename more highways after influential people in Quebec. Because there are so many people that I feel like they deserve a highway to be named after him.
Not only after highways, them. Maybe like buildings.
Highway, buildings.
Schools. More like contemporary people.
Yeah, contemporary figures that like resonate. Because, you know, like Guy Lafleur resonates. You know, he has a statue of him outside of the Bell Center.
He has touched like generations within the
Touched generations. I know you and I last year, we were in downtown during the funeral. And it was huge. It was... There were tents everywhere. The media was everywhere. They blocked the street. It was a big event.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful memorial, honestly.
Yeah, very beautiful memorial. You watched it? Oh, yeah.
We were there.
No, we were there. And also, I was watching it on TV, and I would, like, send you, you know, stories of, like, me watching it, being like, oh, my God, look who arrived. But, yeah, I think it's a great way to honor him. And honestly, I feel like the Quebec government should do this more, not just to Guy Lafleur, but, you know, to other prominent figures.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. So we're going to take a very quick musical break, and then we will be back with more news.
They spread out wide. I give my heart to hands of the wind. She got lost in the sky, in its blue tint, where our eyes were fixed. No pulse on my wrist. Between us, my soul beats silly from my chest. We sit on the swing set from when we were kissed. The knowing
was Orange Juice by Rosie Ramadi featuring Ali Araya. This is Friday off. No, this is Off the Hour Friday. And I'm your host, Carla, joined by my good best friend, Samia. I got it right.
She got it right this time.
Yeah. Continuing on with our third news story of the day. And I feel like this might be the one we spend the most time talking about. So, I mean, the gateway to the story is I saw this article about a cellist from Montreal who's going to perform at King Charles coronation tomorrow. Marion Portelance, 24. She's a graduate from the Conservatoire de Musique de Montréal, and she's currently studying music at the Royal College of Music in London, England. She will perform as part of a quartet comprising of fellow students from the Royal College of Music. They'll play an arrangement of Somewhere from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story. Oh, that's a good choice. The instrument that she will play is a William Forster, cello dating from 1804 that once belonged to King Charles. He played it while he was a student at Cambridge University and now belongs to the Royal College of Music's instrument collection. Other people who will perform at the coronation include Katy Perry, Lionel Richie. They're headlining the concert, and it also feature performances by Andrea Bocelli, Bryn Terfel, Free Writings, and Alexis French. I saw Take That, and I was like, wow, that's a blast from the past. Do you know who Take That is?
No idea.
They're a boy band from the, like, 90s. They're, like, a British boy band.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay. Okay. I wanted to like use this story as a gateway to talk about like the role of monarchy mm-hmm. nowadays, because I don't know, like, I remember hearing about all the people that Buckingham Palace like reached out to perform at the coronation, and no one wanted to do it. Like, no artist would touch it with a 10-foot pole. They asked everyone. They asked Adele, Ed Sheeran, Elton John. I feel like they probably asked the Spice Girls, and everyone said no. Mm-hmm. So they have to ask Katy Perry and Lionel Richie to do it, and they're not even British, so.
They're.
Yeah.
That's such. When you said Katy Perry, Lionel Richie, I was like, that's so random. Yeah. They have no ties to the.
To UK. I mean,
to the UK.
Yeah, and it's like they're American. They separated from the UK like.
Years, like centuries.
Centuries ago. No. Yeah, and. I don't know. I feel like there's not that much excitement about the. I mean, of course, we live in Canada, so there was always going to not be that much excitement about it. But I feel like there's really not a public.
I don't know if it's going to sound bad, but I had no idea that his coronation was tomorrow. And that's like no hate towards.
I mean, a lot of hate. You don't really like the man.
I don't like the man for. I don't know what he's going to be as a king.
Yeah.
But as.
As a prince, we don't have the most favorable
idea of him. Hopefully, yeah. With age, he has, like, changed his ways.
Yeah.
But honestly, like, I don't see anyone being, like, you know, like, obviously, Queen Elizabeth II passed away, and that was...
Huge.
That was huge. It was huge all over the world. Even countries that weren't sovereign to the, you know,
that weren't a part of the Commonwealth, or that weren't, you know, colonized by the... British Empire.
Exactly. But, you know, the coronation is gaining no media attention.
No traction at all.
No one. I don't know if it's appropriate to say this, but I feel like the attention or even the importance given to the British royal monarchy is diminishing.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say. I think it's like. I think of two things. I think the first thing I think of is just that Charles is just not really the most popular member of the royal family. Then I think of the fact that the royal family has been embroiled in so many scandals. Mm-hmm. Recently, I think the one I can think about is Prince Andrew.
Yes, that was horrific.
Horrific, especially since he was Queen Elizabeth's golden child. So mm-hmm. She was very much not going to... punish him in any like substantive way. And then I think of, you know, they're very out of touch, I feel like, from everyday people. And I think I saw a news story that was like that King Charles was inviting people to pledge allegiance to him as a king, and I was like, that is a big misstep, because I think one thing that Queen Elizabeth was very good at was that she very much made it about her being a servant of the people, less so that people were a servant of her, mm-hmm. and that, like, she dedicated her life to the British public for, you know, over 70 years.
Yeah. I mean, she, I think, replacing someone like Queen Elizabeth II is not an easy feat.
No.
Especially when, you know, King Charles isn't even... like well-liked within the Commonwealth or even outside the Commonwealth. It's even harder for him to replace someone that was, I mean, I'm not saying that Queen Elizabeth II wasn't without controversy, but overall her reign was better than other members of the royal family. So I just think also we're at a time where, you know, there's no need for a royal family.
Yeah. And I think one thing that, you know, Queen Elizabeth was, again, as you say, Queen Elizabeth, she's not without fault, but I think one thing she was really good at was to see that the role of the monarchy was changing and adapting with that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, turning the role from being a lot less of like, I rule you, I am the representative of God on earth, to I'm here to serve you. And I'm going to do all these, like, charitable outings, and I'm going to be a patron of all these charities, and I'm going to be, like, you know, a servant of the people and a figurehead of hope when there is none, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, because, you know, I know you watched The Crown because I made you watch it.
Yes.
I love that TV show, even though I'm, like, very much not, like, the biggest proponent of the monarchy. But I think one thing the show showed really well, I think, and especially in the, like, the two earlier seasons, maybe less, like, once Diana comes in and once Charles becomes an adult. But I think one thing the show shows really well is how, like, adaptable Elizabeth was to things that were happening.
Yes.
And how there's, like, a stark difference between, like, her dad's tenure in the throne and her, and how, like, she was able to sort of, like, modernize the monarchy. Because, you know, her wedding was filmed, the coronation was filmed, she did a documentary with her family, she started doing, like, the Christmas messages, and, like, today it seems, like, not that modern to do, but, like...
Back then it was huge.
Back then it was huge. It's like, oh, yes. My God, like, the queen is sending us a birthday, like, a Merry Christmas message every year.
Yes.
I think Charles, it's a lot of things. I think just one, he's very much not, like, personable.
Other than his controversies, I know nothing about him.
Yeah. I know he's a big proponent of climate change.
Yes.
And of, like, sustainability. And I feel like that's the route that he should stick. And I know he's been a proponent of that since, like, the 70s, like, before it was cool to do so. So I feel like that's maybe something that he should really, like, lean heavy on, because it is, I think, an issue that will... I'm putting my, like, little, like, PR marketing hat on, but I feel like that would really endear him to, you know, younger generations if he's, like, big on, like...
And I feel like it's a lot of people are just... assuming he's going to give the throne soon to William.
Yeah.
So not giving as much attention to King Charles.
Yeah, because he's in his 70s. Like, he's not going
to
be...
I don't know. I feel like not to, you know...
Diminish
him. But I feel like William, which is... He is younger.
Yeah.
He is... I don't know. I feel like he's more relatable. As relatable as a royal family, a person born, raised in the royal family can be. Because we can't expect any relatability from someone who was raised, born, you know.
In like the aristocrat of aristocrats, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly. In front of the media, their whole life being documented. It's not the same.
Yeah.
We can't just expect
relatability.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, like, yeah, I feel like if I were his PR team, I would really lean heavy on the sustainability part. Mm-hmm. But I think I would change with the times. I think I would recognize the fact that people think that the monarchy is a diminishing institution.
Yes.
And I would acknowledge. I know it's really hard to acknowledge that, you know, like, that, like, you're becoming irrelevant. It's really hard to do, but I feel like it's necessary.
Not only that, it's like a lot of countries are no longer...
Yeah.
There's no longer an important royal family.
Yeah.
It's very rare to see that. A lot of them are just, like, a symbolic figure.
Yeah.
That's what's becoming in with the British royal family. They're more of a symbolic figure. More there to be like, okay, in times of needs, we are here. Everything's okay. But with the... When there's core issues, we don't really turn towards, even as...
I mean, they can't really even speak on politics. That's the thing. Like, they're, like, notoriously, like, apolitical. They don't speak on politics, like, at all.
Their power is very limited as well.
Yeah, their power is very limited. And here, it's not even the royal family. It's the governor general that, like...
Yes. Like, if you ask any Canadian here about their opinion, I don't even know if some of them know... We're part of the Commonwealth.
Yeah. I think I pulled a quote, actually. So when Justin Trudeau was asked last week about, because it was, Justin Trudeau is going to attend the coronation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, Yves-François Blanchet from the Bloc Québécois, he commented and said that it was like a slap in the face to all Canadians, which, I mean, the Bloc is the Bloc, so I understand their position, because they don't really want to be tied mm-hmm. to the monarchy, and they don't want to be tied to the Canadian government, so it makes sense that for them, it's like, it's a slap in the face. But on paper, the head of Canada is the queen.
Yes.
Now the king. So, like, yeah, he has to be there, like, regardless of what his feelings are on the royal family. And I know that he was close with Queen Elizabeth.
I mean, I feel like they got along.
Yeah, from what I hear, they were close because she knew him as a child because his dad was prime minister. So mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, they knew each other. They were, you know, maybe not like the best of friends, but, you know, they were friendly with one another. But when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was asked last week whether it's time for Canada to hold a referendum on whether to sever ties with the British monarchy, he said he believes Canadians are focused on bigger issues, which I have to agree.
I mean, the whole issue is... surrounding referendums here, I think, no longer holds the same weight as it did back in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, if you ask anyone, do you... Because, like, the power of the British monarchy is even less visible here in Canada.
Yeah.
It's like, if they're a symbolic figure over there, and here in Canada, even less so.
Yeah, I feel like unless you're doing your, like, Canadian citizenship exam, most people don't spend a second thinking about...
Yeah, and, like, you might see Queen Elizabeth II on your $10 bill.
On your $20 bill, which you're going to have to change that soon. And I have to say, one thing that... Here's the thing. Charles is not going to be here long. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. I feel like they should keep Queen Elizabeth on the $20 bill.
I think that's a good way to commemorate her memory.
Yeah.
Just you can keep her.
Put him on the coins. Put him on the coins. But I think one thing I especially want to talk about, because I think I talked to this with you last year when the Queen died. I don't think people realize how complicated it would be to sever ties.
Yes.
With the British monarchy.
Isn't it like years?
It's entrenched in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not a constitutional expert. I have friends in law school. I should probably ask them later. And, you know, maybe Mario or Matthew would respond to my text later. But I'm pretty sure you would have to open up the Constitution to change it to that Canada.
And just retrieving it here is going to take.
It's here. I mean.
It's here?
Yeah. It was repatriated in 1982.
Oopsie.
I'm the Canadian politics expert. Between the both of us.
I hate Canadian politics. No offense.
But, you know, like, you would have to open the Constitution. And I think one thing that the federal government is very wary of doing is opening up the federal Constitution, because then that opens a can of worms of questions that you're going to need to address, such as Quebec not having signed the Constitution, Quebec's place in Canada.
Quebec's like that one annoying child, you know, in a big family.
I love Quebec, but you know, there's a bunch of issues, you know, there's so many like constitutional issues that people are going to have, like, once you open the Constitution, it's a can of worms that you cannot put back, you know, you're going to have people who are like, oh, well, while we're at it, we're going to have to discuss, you know, like the rights of our provinces, and the people are going to want to like rewrite parts of the Constitution. I feel like that's a battle that the federal government does not want to engage in, which, like, rightfully so. If I was prime minister, I would also be like, oh, hell no, I am not opening up the Constitution.
Like, I'm potentially leaving this for the next prime minister to deal with.
It's not something that you want to deal with. It's a very complex issue with, like, a lot of moving parts. So just for that, I feel like, and also, this is going to sound wrong, but I'm saying this from the perspective of the Canadian government, not the Quebec government. The ties to the British monarchy are less colonial, and it's a lot less like tied to oppression than it is in Quebec.
Yeah, their power is very limited here in Canada.
Yeah, I took history of Canada from 1914 to 1945, and this was an exam question on like the sovereignty of Canada towards the UK. And people... Before World War One, people were really happy to be subjects of the British Empire, except for Quebec. Everything I say is except for Quebec, you know? People were really happy to be British subjects. It's only after the Battle of Vimy Ridge in 1917 that people start to say, maybe we should be independent. And even then, there are some people who are like, no, I still want to be a British subject.
Even to this day,
there are people,
that are fine.
There are people who are fine. And honestly, I think that, yeah, we should sever ties with the British monarchy because it's like very like purely symbolic. I recognize that it's too complicated. It's a very complex issue that like maybe we're not really ready for.
This might be just my take, but yeah. I think it's less of Quebec versus the British monarchy, more so Quebec versus Canada.
Yeah.
That's what I think the issue is. And I honestly don't think that separating from the Commonwealth is going to solve big issues here in Canada.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I know that Quebec views itself as being colonized by the UK, which, like, I mean, like, it absolutely was. The way that, you know, the Durham Report and the way that restrictions was posed on Quebec and, you know, people's ability to, you know, live out their culture, speak their language, which, like, again, I come from a colonized country and you too, so we like completely understand that. It's a different degree. It's not like the same as, you know, like slavery or, you know, I know you're from Sri Lanka, so it's a lot of like institutionalized racism by the Portuguese.
I don't know if you're going to have a quick little history lesson, but Sri Lanka was colonized by a lot of different people.
Yeah.
But more than the Portuguese, the devastating results were left by actually the British people. Yeah. Because Sri Lanka is composed of two huge ethnic groups, which are the Sinhalese and the Tamil people. And when the British occupied Sri Lanka, back then it was called Ceylon, they favored one ethnic group over another. And once, you know, Sri Lanka gained its independence and they left, there was this huge ethnic war within Sri Lanka, not with the British, but within, you know, the Tamil community and the Sinhalese community, which ended in devastating losses, you know,
civil wars,
the destruction of, you know, sacred places, people, you know, Sri Lanka to this day has one of the world's highest disappearance rates, unexplained disappearances.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's, I think to a degree, this is similar to what's happening here in Quebec. It's not, again,
to me, what it echoes is kind of like the Rwandan genocide, but like before, like a lot less extreme of, like, you know, the Belgian, in that case was the Belgian government propping up the Tutsi people, the Tutsi people, despite the fact that they were like a minority in the population. And then that led to when the Hutu took power, they basically massacred all the Tutsis because you had like decades and centuries of sort of like imposed colonial, like, I don't want to say beef, but like conflict between like two ethnic nations who are like essentially like a part of the same people. But that's like the story of like so many countries.
So many countries have been affected by this.
Yeah.
So we can't really, you know, diminish the sentiments felt by the Quebecois. Like, it makes sense because it's not the same degree of intensity, but it's the same feeling.
Yeah.
Where it's a us against them sentiment.
And statistically, it's true because, like, French Canadians were, like, paid less than their Anglophone counterparts.
Exactly. Same thing happened in Sri Lanka. Yeah. Same thing happened in Rwanda. It's the same. It's the same. How do you call it? It's like a domino effect.
Yeah.
After the colonization, I mean, we're still part of the Commonwealth, but, you know, it's a domino effect, and those domino effects create very strong sentiments, which leads to, you know, issues like the referendum.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I think just it's an issue that's going to, like, it's going to keep existing. I don't think it's going to, like, get fixed. It's not a quick fix. It's something that's going to, like, probably take decades.
And honestly, even though, like, you know, the older generation is dwindling down, I feel like it's a sentiment you pass on from generation to generation, so this sentiment might still be here when our kids are alive.
We'll see. The coronation of King Charles III is tomorrow. I don't know what time, but yeah, it's probably gonna be streamed online and you can watch it at your
local TikTok.
It's probably gonna be on CBC, probably not on TVA, but King Charles coronation is tomorrow. Do you want to take a break or do you want to keep going?
We can keep going.
You can keep going. So today is the 5th of May, which is Cinco de Mayo.
Ooh.
And I kind of wanted to talk about Cinco de Mayo because to me, Cinco de Mayo is like one, it reminds me a lot of St. Patrick's Day in that, like, it's for a lot of people, it's like a drinking holiday. It's like an excuse to get drunk.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, it is like a holiday for many people that represents something sacred. So I did some research on Cinco de Mayo.
Before we start, say that.
Yeah. What do you think that Cinco de Mayo is?
It's the day where we celebrate the death. Dead. Sorry.
No, that is not Cinco de Mayo. That is the Day of the Dead.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Please. This is life, but please cancel.
Okay. So Cinco de Mayo, or the 5th of May, is a holiday that celebrates the date of the Mexican Army's May 5th, 1862 victory over France at the Battle of Puebla during the Franco-Mexican War. The day, which falls on Friday, May 5th in 2023, is also known as the Battle of Puebla Day. While it is a relatively minor holiday in Mexico, in the United States, Cinco de Mayo has evolved into a commemoration of Mexican culture and heritage, particularly in areas of large Mexican-American population. It is not to be confused with Mexican Independence Day, which that is on September 16th. Okay. It's not Independence Day. And it, I know that in Mexico, it's not like a huge... Like, it is like a celebration, but it's not like, you know, it's not like a bank holiday where, like, people, like, they get off of work. It's just like, you know, a commemoration of that victory. So basically, like, the very, like, long short story is that it commemorates a single battle. In 1861, Benito Juarez, a lawyer and member of the indigenous Zapotec tribe, was elected the president of Mexico. At the time, the country was in financial ruin after years of internal strife, and the president was forced to default on debt payments to European government. In response, France, Britain, and Spain, the usual suspects in colonization, I'm sorry, I have to say it because it's true,
y'all did great.
Yeah, sent naval forces to Veracruz, Mexico, demanding repayment. Britain and Spain negotiated with Mexico and withdrew their forces. France, however, ruled by Napoleon III, decided to use the opportunity to carve out an empire out of the Mexican territory. Late in 1861, a well-armed French fleet stormed Veracruz, landing a force of troops and driving President Juarez and his government into retreat, and then they were able to defeat them.
I am so sorry for thinking that's the Day of the Dead.
It's not the Day of... I mean, I understand why you would make that, like... Because it is, you know, but they're two different holidays. But I think it was important just to, like, highlight that because...
It is.
Sometimes you celebrate stuff and you don't even know what you're celebrating.
I'm like, I literally celebrated Cinco de Mayo without knowing what Cinco de Mayo was.
Yeah. And I think it's important sometimes to know, like, what you're celebrating and the history behind it so that you can appreciate it more. Same with St. Patrick's Day. You know, like, you and I, we were like, oh, it's a holiday where, you know, college kids have an excuse to get drunk.
But, we
you know,
love St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, but it does represent something more to people. Yes. And I feel like it's important. Like, you can have fun and be drunk, but, you know.
Be respectful while doing it.
Yeah, be respectful and be aware of what you're getting drunk for. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the message. Lastly, before we take a musical break, it is the month of May, which is Haitian Heritage Month. That's how we call it in Canada. I imagine that Pacific Islanders are included in this.
Yes, they are.
Yes. It's an, according to the Canadian government, I took this from their website. The month of May is also Asian Heritage Month. It is an opportunity for us to learn more about the diverse culture and history of Asian communities in Canada, as well as to acknowledge the many achievements and contributions of people of Asian origin who throughout history have done so much to make Canada the country we know and love.
So I am South Asian.
Yeah.
So it is our month this month, and I, for one, during this month, think about all the people that had to... I typically think about all the people, especially here in Canada, that immigrated, you know, following wars or, you know, losses or whatever. You know, I really think about the immigrants that had to be displaced from home and, you know, how they had to essentially build a new life in a new country, especially in Canada. It's not, especially here in Quebec, it's not easy where you have to learn a completely new, like, I mean, English was, you know, it's pretty universal, but French is not. And, you know, me being from a second generation, you know, immigrant household, I truly do value this month.
Yeah. I'm really happy to have you on because I'm not Asian, so I can't really, like, I can't speak to the Asian experience the same way that, you know, you probably can't speak to, like, the Black experience. They're, like, two radically different things.
Yeah.
And I know that there's been debates about, you know, what is considered Asian. But I'm happy to have you here, honestly. Happy month.
Yes, South Asians are considered Asian.
Yeah, despite what Ronnie Chang or anybody else tries to make you feel, they are entirely South Asians are a part of Asia. And Asia is so diverse, and I feel like we
Asia
never...
Asia is incredibly diverse, yeah. And I think that's... It's so sad that a lot of people think that Asia, when you think about someone who's Asian, you think about, you know...
Korean, Japanese, and Chinese,
people from Thailand or Vietnamese, and that's all you think of. But no, like, they're so diverse. There's people from Afghanistan, there's people from Sri Lanka, there's people from, you know,
Kazakhstan, Bangladesh,
Nepal. It's very, very diverse.
It's very diverse, and there's so many cultures and traditions, and, you know, I think it's just important to highlight those people, especially in Montreal, where, you know, there's the Asian presence is a lot less than you would see in, you know, Toronto or Vancouver. But, you know, Asian people are important here, and they have contributed a lot. You know, we have Chinatown, we have, you know, the railway, All those are like Asian contributions to the country that we live in. And I feel like, especially since, you know, when you consider the fact that before 1967, Canada was quite a racist country when it came to immigration.
Yes.
And that it blocked almost all immigration from Asia, especially Chinese immigration. That was a huge thing that they were trying to block. So, I mean, I'm happy that now, you know, there has been like a sort of a retroactive change of philosophy, because I think diversity makes us better. So,
and I don't know about you, but growing up in Montreal, I think, you know, a lot less traumatizing than it would be in other places.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very rich and diverse place, not only for Asian people, but other communities as well. It's very nice to see all these communities not only bringing their culture from their native homes, but also blending it in with other cultures. I think that's really nice.
Yeah. So we're going to take a short musical break. This is going to be, this is going to be Joy Crooks with Sinatra. And yeah, then we're going to wrap up.
I stayed too long. I should have heard the sirens. I blame it on temptation in my system. Casino eyes and golden hands, you grip my waist, won't let me go, singing words that make me stay. Sinatra charm, a silver tongue, a devil had the blue sea cradled on his arm. Those sweeter days don't taste the same. I never learned to walk away. Talk so differently, daily dose my remedy, got me out here smoking more, your influence, round of applause, losing more than I have won.
So that was Sinatra by Joe Crooks, who's actually of Bangladeshi origin. So that ended up being a fun coincidence. The last thing I want to talk about before we round out this show, I sent you an article earlier in the week that I found interesting. So it is titled, because I know it's a news show, but I feel like this like does fit into the news with the slate of recent anti-LGBTQ and sort of legislation that's been adopted in the U.S. It's called Dylan Mulvaney Wanted to Be an Actor, Not an Activist. It is by Aaron Walker, and it is on Bustle. You and I both follow Dylan Mulvaney, who, for reference for most people, she is a trans woman. on TikTok who started chronicling her journey into transitioning on TikTok with her series called Days of Girlhood. So basically every day she'd be like, oh, this is day 10 of being a girl, this is day 35 of being a girl, and she basically like chronicled her transition from start to, well, until today basically.
I have to say I love her.
Yeah,
she radiates, you know, positivity, and she's just so upright, you know. But I don't know if you, I'm sure you're aware, but in recent times, like, people have really been at her, you know, really coming at her for the most outrageous reasons.
Yeah, so basically, like, right now, there has been a slew of anti-LGBTQ legislation that has been enacted in the U.S., and a lot of it is very, what I would say, like, draconian. It very much intrudes in people's everyday lives. And I mean, like, here's the thing though, like, trans rights are rights, like, you know, mm-hmm. And the thing is, when you entrench on a lot of people, of trans people's right to like express themselves, you know that it affects them mentally, and you know that it like shoots up the percentage of people who try to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. So, and I really don't understand this sort of insistence on like policing trans people. I feel like it's kind of like the new, like, boogeyman, if that makes sense. Like, remember how back in, like, the 90s and the early 2000s, it was really, they were coming after gay people. They were like, gay, being gay is not normal. Mm-hmm. And before that, in the 50s and the 60s, it was interracial relationships. So I feel like there's always, like,
something new.
Something new that people try to, like, cram down on. And I really don't understand it, because, like, a trans woman is not, like, threatening your womanhood. Right. And if you take a lot of this legislation, like, example, if you were born biologically male and you transition, you have to go through the bathroom of the gender you were assigned at birth. I don't know about you. If I would not be comfortable with a trans man who identifies as a man being in a girl's restroom, like, that's not, it's counterproductive.
What I think is really ironic is the fact that, I don't know about you, but at my school, inclusive bathrooms for both male and women are becoming more and more of a thing, and No one is complaining.
No one complains about
it. No one complains. If you feel unsafe, you have your own bathroom that you can lock and use. But honestly, no one is complaining. I don't know. I feel like a lot of these complaints come from the older generation that are refusing to change. At the end of the day, Dylan Mulvaney is not harming any of us.
Yeah.
She is doing whatever feels good for her.
Yeah.
And like her, many other trans people are transitioning for themselves, not for the validation of other people.
Yeah, and I think a great thing that was pointed out by the article, and also to bring like a sort of an anecdote, my lab partner in Sec 3 came out as trans that year. They changed their name since then. I don't know what it is, so I'm not going to like say they're dead. I'm not going to date them. But I remember how much he had to struggle, especially during senior year of high school, because we had someone put a really transphobic quote in their high school. They like quoted Ben Shapiro. Mm-hmm. And I remember me and my friend going to the principal's office and being like, hey, this is really transphobic, and you have a trans student in your year, so like you should not allow this. And I remember them making a lot of excuses, but it's like, hey, you're like harming the welfare of like a kid. Because at the end of the day, this is like a 17-year-old like that you're harming by allowing that quote to be in the yearbook. And to the point of the article, Dylan Mulvaney, all they wanted to do was share their lives, share her life. That's all she wanted to do. Share her life, which included her transitioning from male to female.
And
her life as an actor, and like just share that with people. And all of a sudden, her just sharing her day-to-day life of like, oh, hey, I went and I did my nails, or oh, hey, I went and I tried on dresses at like the Burberry store. It's turned political, when it's not. It's just a person living their life. And I am a person who believes that everything is inherently like political, because, you know, it's like dictated by, you know, like decisions that are made by people at the higher up, and, you know, taxes are political, and, you know, but I don't understand why you're politicizing a person just like living their life, and it's not harming you. Bothering you. Dylan Mulvaney didn't have an affair with your wife. Like, calm down, you know?
What I think is horrible is people saying that she is going to influence or turn all these kids trans. That's not true.
Yeah.
Like these beauty gurus that are posting, you know, get ready with me. The same thing for Dylan Mulvaney. She's just showing her everyday life, and a big part of her life is her transitioning.
Yeah.
And it's not her fault that she became this quote-unquote face of the trans community.
Yeah, and she became the face of the trans community despite the fact that she didn't sign up mm-hmm. to be the face of the trans community. And, you know, people get mad at her. You know, the Bud Light thing, so I didn't like the partnership when it was announced for completely different reasons. It wasn't because I was like, oh, she doesn't belong in Bud Light. I was just like, Dylan Mulvaney does not strike me as a Bud Light person. I see her more as like a Cosmo, like a Manhattan girly, you know, maybe a daiquiri. Aperol spritz. I just was like, okay, this doesn't make sense because I don't see her drinking beer on the regular.
She loves pina coladas, guys.
She loves pina coladas, you know, like I just saw her as like, you know, a girl's, you know, maybe not someone who like drinks beer, but that was my problem with it. It wasn't the fact that she was like,
I just thought, yeah. Honestly, I had no, I mean, I'm someone that doesn't get like this huge sentiment towards ads and who yeah. they pick to advertise ads, whatever.
Yeah.
When I saw that, she was, you know, campaigning for them. I was like, good for her.
Yeah.
Make that bank, girl.
Yeah. And I mean, especially when you see all the like anti-trans legislation, like in Florida, they're making that if you give your child gender affirming care, that the social services can come and take them from you. Like that is scary.
That's scary because why is the government dictating what you are doing with your child? If you're physically not harming your child, it is not the government's business.
And also it's going against the point of social services, which is to save children from abusive household or households where their needs are not met. Like,
I mean, I feel like you can literally have an yeah. entire episode on, you know, the yeah. social system and the system for kids.
Yeah. And the thing with, you know, gender affirming care, I think a lot of people just see it as like, oh, you could just like go to like Shokutsu and buy hormones. It doesn't work like that. You need to go through several doctors, several, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists. You have to be like diagnosed with gender dysphoria mm-hmm. before you can even get gender affirming care. And I don't see how you could fake that with like multiple psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, like if you're with a qualified professional, I feel like they're able to discern what is like you just having a phase and what it's like you having like truly like gender dysphoria. But even then, I don't think that should like impact your ability to, you know, receive gender affirming care.
I feel like we should protect yeah. trans people and leave them alone. Like what we have learned time and time again, same thing with the interracial couple issue, same thing with gay rights issues, people try to stop it,
but with time people realize that there's like
it was wrong.
Yeah,
there was nothing wrong.
Yeah,
what the only wrong thing was people trying to stop people from simply living
yeah.
their true selves. And
yeah,
time again will tell how the way we treat trans people or the trans community is horrific.
And trans people are not new. They're not like a new,
it's
people act like it's a new fad. It's not. Like trans people have existed since like way before. My dad had two trans students when mm-hmm. I think I was six. My dad took me on a field trip with his students, and he had a student named Tanya, and she was like decked out in pink, and I was like, oh my god, you are my favorite person ever, because I love pink and I'm like 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I freaked out, and she was great. She gave me a Kit Kat bar. I love Tanya. If you're listening to this, you're amazing. And but you know, they're not new. They've been there. And
even in religion,
yeah, they're just trying to survive.
In Hindu religion,
yeah,
trans people have always been there.
Yeah.
And they're actually worshipped.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, goes to show that
it's not our business. Anyways, Samia, thank you for being with me on your first show. I think you did an amazing job.
Thank
honestly.
You. Made a few mistakes,
but you know, we got back up and we continue. This was Friday Off the Hour. I'm gonna leave you off with Je Quitte by Charlotte Cardin. Have a good one, guys, and have a good weekend.
Bye.
Moi j'ai bien compris, tu danses vers les autres rires, tout au ralenti, sans fil, s'avance vers nos zones grises. Je dors quand tu pars et je sors quand tu tardes. Mon rôle quand tu râles est de calmer ton vacarme. Nos corps.
qui s'éteignent. Toi tu meurs quand tu m'aimes, moi je meurs quand tu m'aimes. Je quitte, mais je ne te quitte pas. Je passe tes passifs, je t'embrasse un instant furtif, l'ombre de ton nom brille dans la chambre, toute celle que je te chante. Tu dors quand je parle et tu sors quand je bavarde. Je suis seule, on part et je me pose et je chiale. Et nos corps qui s'éteignent, moi je mords quand je t'aime. Je meurs mais je t'aime. Je quitte.